My name is Mickey Milner, and I am a grateful, recovering alcoholic. I don't think it says here I'm to make announcements. I really don't think we have any. The hotel has asked that we depart because they, as you know, they do have another convention coming in. All right, here's some announcements. Excuse me. Thank you. I didn't arrive at this place at this time this morning by being moderate in anything I ever did. I have the privilege to introduce our speaker this morning who I could, if gotten carried away, could probably spend his time in just covering his past performances, which are indeed outstanding. I'm going to read one or two things that have appeared in some newspapers. Morris Lookout will testify Wednesday before the House Interstate Commerce Committee on legislation to designed to mount a massive national attack on alcoholism. Lookout is an industrial consultant for the Tulsa Council on Alcoholism, and that's part of the National Council. That's one very brief clipping. Another clipping from another paper. A Tulsa industrial consultant Wednesday urged the House subcommittee to act quickly on authorizing a major federal attack on the problems of alcoholism. And so on and so on and so on. I spent quite a bit of time yesterday and this morning with Morris in trying to examine my man, in trying to find out what would be of interest to you, and what, because of obvious, because he can't blow his own horn too much, to dig out of him these many and varied accomplishments. We all cannot pick up a newspaper or a magazine and not read about the tremendous social changes going on in this country, primarily in the area of the blacks. But we have other great problems in this country, and one of them is the American Indian. Morris is an Indian, and he is the grandson of an Indian chief, an Osage Indian chief, but not just an Indian chief. And I picked this out. I caught this. The last Indian chief by heredity. In other words, he is the grandson of one by the divine right of kings, as opposed to someone like King Farouk, who was elected or took over. He is by the divine right, going back hundreds of years. They now are elected. He is a composer of Indian music, and I could tell he was very proud of this. He has been initiated into the Kiowa Apache tribe, which is a separate and distinct entity from what he tells me on the various tribes of our Indian nations in this country. He is a strong man, and I could tell this in my chat with him yesterday. He's a graduate of the University of Oklahoma State University. He attended Columbia in New York. He's a graduate of the Rutgers School on Alcoholism. And as I said, I don't want to overdo this thing. I have many and various additional things I could say. The veil of tears that the Indians have had and the trials that they've had, I see shared on this man's shoulders. There's no doubt about this. So I'm going to stop now and simply introduce Morris.
Now, if you really want to know how, you should read the fifth chapter. Some 300 years ago, the poor ignorant Indian ran this country. There were no debts, no taxes, no sheriffs, no jails, meat was free, and the women did all the work. And then the white man took over and called it improvement. The thought of improvement has crossed my mind many, many times during this period of recovery. And I think of it almost constantly. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Morris Lookout, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm an Indian alcoholic. Any remarks you may have to say about my name being Lookout, then keep them to yourself, because I've heard it all and none of it is original. I always attribute part of this to my problem. I had a great deal of resentment against my name because so many years back, when the white man came into our country, he couldn't pronounce our Indian name, so in his own way, he interpreted the literal translation. And what my name really means is an eagle on a hill in a tree overlooking the countryside. So he simply shortened it to Lookout. So as a result, my name is Lookout. I'd like to preface anything that I have to say by stating that anything I have to contribute are my own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Fellowship of AA or any individual member. I find this more or less kind of clears the air to let me say what I believe has been beneficial to me. And so often I stand up here and, of course, this morning I searched through my mind as to what I was going to say. And I had the good fortune of having lunch with Mary Frances and the group. And at the conclusion, she got up and she said, "Well, we're looking forward to hearing you tomorrow." And I says, "I'm looking forward to hearing me too, because I'm wondering what I'm going to say." But now we've came to that moment of truth, and here I am. And I think it sort of compulsory that I stand up here and more or less give a brief rundown of my drinking history. I feel it necessary that to me that I qualify myself. But I'm going to more or less cover it rather briefly, because today I'm more concerned about the principles that I live by, the things that I've gained through this wonderful fellowship of this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. But like so many others, I began drinking at an early age. I drank my way through high school. And upon graduation from high school, I was inducted into the service. And as I look back, I can see that at this early age, I was fairly well down the road with alcoholism. Even so that I remember that just before I was discharged, then I rebelled something terrible. I know that when the officers would come around and they'd call attention, I wouldn't stand to attention. I wouldn't salute. All I wanted was to be out. At that time, I didn't speak English very fluently. I had difficulty in communicating. I knew that it was inherent with me to honor my parents in serving my country in time of battle. And I had done this. And now that everything apparently had been satisfied, I wanted out. and no one understood why I wanted out. And finally, they did make some sort of amends and call me in, and the commanding general says, well, we understand that you're Indian, and we're going to make special allowances, and we're going to ship you home. And I came home, and I returned to the streets. And fortunately, since I didn't have any money, I took advantage of the GI Bill, and I returned to school. Possibly one of the best things that I'd ever done without realizing it. But I drank my way through college. And after coming out of college, I returned again to my hometown and took up my place as one of the town drunks. I contributed to the cities. They prospered very much because I did pay my fines whenever I had the money. I was in and out of city jails and most of the county jails. Fortunately, I didn't ever make the state penitentiary. I've been through separate maintenance. I've been divorced. Anything you can think of that we alcoholics can get ourselves into, I believe I suffered through. At the ripe old age of 24 years, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And way back there in 1949, when AA was just beginning in the state of Oklahoma, I took up membership in the fellowship. And I walked in the door and was surprised to see so many people advanced in years, so many of the hardcore alcoholics at that time who had only one way to go, and that was up. And they were taking particular advantage of this program. They had been drinking for innumerable years. And to see someone of 24 years come walking up the steps, and at that time with very little knowledge of what the illness concept consisted of, didn't take too kindly. And they even went so far as to say, well, boy, you're really fortunate that you have been able to understand what your situation is, and you don't have to go down that hard road like I've had to. You know, I particularly emphasize this point today because I travel considerably throughout the United States in my work, and I run into so many people in their late 20s who are coming into the program, a relative few in their early 20s, and some teenagers. And I think this is a tribute to what we have accomplished in those opposed to what we believed in the early years. There's been great strides in the removal of the social stigma attached to alcoholism. And we see so many people who we now regard as high bottom drunks coming into the fellowship. And regardless of age, I think we shouldn't overlook the fact that everyone has his own hell to go through. And just because that young fellow didn't experience the years of drinking that maybe an older one had doesn't necessarily mean that his hell isn't twice as great as the other one's, or at least he feels it as such. But this created quite a bit of resentment. There was no way that I could identify as I look back. So unfortunately, I proceeded to drink again after a year of sobriety. With return visits to the program, then in the year 1960, I came back to AA. For what reason, I don't know. I know that I had to have one good drunk. Of course, my drunks lasted anywhere from 1 week to 30 days. I had just been fired from a very high position with one of our oil companies there in the state of Oklahoma. I had started in the oil fields by roughnecking and roustabouting, finally working my way up to a district sales engineer, and was about to take over a branch, and I was fired for my alcoholism. And I continued to drink for about a 6 month period, imbibing real heavily daily, two fifths a day. But my family had divorced me and they had moved to Tulsa. So over a period of this 6 months, I had made attempts to get to Tulsa, finally getting there at the end of about a 6 month period. And I went to my wife. She let me in the house. And I got down on my knees and I cried. I said, please take me back. I am sincere and I want to do something about my problem. And she says, no, I'm not. So I stood up and dried my eyes and told her to go to hell. You know, I think Dick was correct. And of course, this says in the big book, as he says, that, you know, we alcoholics are actors. All of us. We're con artists. We're pathological liars. We're phenomenal people. Yet our intelligence seems to be far above average. We're fascinating people, and I'm always amazed at the abilities. I never underestimate an alcoholic. I never underestimate them. I think you can stand alone on the street, naked, and inside of an hour he'll have a new suit of clothes on, $20, and be drunk. After I had dried my eyes, I left the house and proceeded to get drunk. And I drank and I drank and I drank. I don't remember anything. A few incidences came up. And the next thing I remember, I was outside of the car and I was leaning against the car and the police were shaking me down. You know, we alcoholics, we're really lucky people. They should have taken me to jail, but they didn't. I wish they had have taken me to jail, but they took me home. And there was the wife. She did agree to let me in rather than see me go to jail. I don't understand why. Maybe this was the time. But I called Alcoholics Anonymous, as I had called them in the past, and they came like they have always came. Unfortunately, one of them was a fellow that I had grown up with, who later became my sponsor, and the other fellow with him was a co-sponsor, as I regarded him. But they came out and spent the night with me. They stayed by my side. And after they had left, after I had gone to sleep, when they thought that I had awakened, they called me. They made a point to come back over that evening and pick me up. And they took me to a meeting. And they brought me home. And they urged me to call them if anything should come up. And I took advantage of this. I spent hours on the telephone talking with them or just listening. They came again and again and again. But I know that the first 6 months in the program were rather vague. My mind was terribly confused. I couldn't even read the newspaper. I couldn't do nothing but sit and listen. These men stuck with me. The other day I was discussing this with some people about sponsorship. And it's been of great concern to me because I know that in my early sobriety, way back there in 1960, and then again it doesn't seem so far back, that whenever we sponsored anybody, we took them to meetings for a period of time, depending upon each individual, for as long as we felt it necessary, and this may go on for several months. Because I'm a believer in alcoholism is an illness. Sometimes I feel that maybe those members of the fellowship are their own worst enemy in failing to recognize. And I feel that we're more or less kind of like the general public. We admit. You can stop the average man on the street and you say, what do you think about alcoholism? And he'll say, it's an illness. But you let someone come staggering in and fall down at his feet and he'll look down and he'll say, well, the idiot ought to know better. This seems to be the consensus of the general public, but the fact remains that it is recognized as an illness. But is it accepted? This is where the question arises. Is it completely accepted? Is it accepted by us, Do we completely understand what the illness concept is? How many of us are guilty of saying, you know, he didn't want to, the reason he got drunk or he had a relapse is because he didn't want to stay sober. He wanted to get drunk more than he wanted to stay sober. Now, you know what he's got to do? He's got to go out here and drink until he finds his bottom, and then he's really got to want this program. You can't help an alcoholic unless he wants to be helped. So we stand idly by and watch someone destroy himself. You know, people who are suffering from mental illnesses, people who are suffering from known socially respectable illnesses, whenever they choose not to do something about it, we urge them. We find methods to motivate them. People who are unable to help themselves and are a menace to society and a menace to themselves, we have laws governing them. We commit them. We see readily that there's a definite need to do something, take it upon ourselves to do something for these people. I feel we should do the same for alcoholism. I know that there are limits to the principles that we abide by, but I feel that we owe it to ourselves and to that afflicted individual to intervene. And a word that I'd coin, which I like to call constructive intervention, should be applicable in this situation. I think if we're going to take the responsibility of an individual's sobriety, assume sponsorship or co-sponsorship in trying to help this individual, then we should take responsibility for his relapses. I never say, you know, it's unfortunate that this is the only illness where we blame the individual for his relapses. He didn't want to stay sober bad enough. When someone has a relapse, I wonder, where did I fail him? Where did I fail him? I believe that recovery is long-term. We're fighting an illness. I'm trying to emphasize the impact of this situation. We say that there are between 6 to 8 million alcoholics in the United States today. And that's a minimum, believe me. That's a minimum estimate. If alcoholism was contagious, we'd declare a national emergency. And there'd be utter chaos throughout the United States. This problem is this serious? But we ourselves, I think, should understand the illness concept. We in AA say it's a tripartite illness. We're sick in mind, body, and soul. You know, when I first came into this program, they said this is a spiritual program. And I was in complete agreement, because as far as I was concerned, I've been spiritually oriented all my life. I come from a race of people who I believe are the most religious people in the whole world today. I'm a strong believer in spirituality. And it wasn't too difficult for me to accept. And I noticed that it isn't too difficult for the majority of we in the fellowship to accept this. So when we come back, we accept it. And in due time, we go back to the church of our choice. And we accept it with dignity. And of course, sick in spiritually and then sick in body isn't too difficult to understand. I know that after 2 years of sobriety, I went immediately to my physician and I had a complete checkup. Over a period of years, I began to develop these little pains, you know, that I never was aware of before. And for the first time in my life, I got headaches and my feet ached me and I began to get nervous. And a number of things that I needed to have. And I wasn't too opposed to recognizing that this was part of this illness was physiological. Then we say, well, were sick in mind. Who, me?
Oh, no, not me. Psychologically sick?
No, I don't completely accept that. Insane. One of the words in some of our books that we use to conduct discussion classes has the word insane. This word, you don't hear it too much anymore. We use other words in a milder form that are not so, have such a stigma attached to them. Emotional illness, mental illnesses, emotional disorders, so on down the line. Insanity? I was insane. I need to tell myself that. But so many of us, and I know that in my case, I always blamed alcohol. Oh, I was in my right mind. It's only when I get drunk that I do all these irrational things, that I begin to try and hurt people and hurt myself. How many of us understand why? Why? You know, this individual who took that first drink, knowing full well what it had done to him in the past, took that drink. Now, was that the mind of a rational person that took that first drink? He wasn't on alcohol then. He was insane to take that first drink. You know, I say that we people are phenomenal. In my business, I consult with a number of alcoholics, usually those in high positions in the government and in the industry. And they'll look at me and they'll say, I can quit anytime I want to. And you know I believe them. I'm serious now because I believe I could quit anytime I want to when I'm drinking. And I would, just despite that old boy I was talking to. I'd quit. But the question is, when was I going to start again? I didn't know that. I can quit anytime I want to. Well, that doesn't mean anything to me. And you know another thing? I don't ever drink on a job. I said, the hell you don't. But anyway, I believe all these things. And I see this so much in our ability to rationalize. Pathological lying, they call it. I know that whenever talking about my alcoholism, I like to think back at what they used to say, what my wife used to say. Oh, he's a nice fella when he's not drinking. He's a prince of a guy. He does my washing. He takes care of the kids. He does my ironing. He runs errands for me. And the boss will say, by golly, he can do twice the work of anybody I got. Whenever he does a job, he does it right. Why is it that we're good fellows? Why is it that we're such hard workers? But this is only for a short period of time. After this interval between drunks begins to get longer, then we begin to get irritable. And who's the first one to know that we're getting ready to get drunk? It's that little woman, right? She knows that I'm going to get drunk. She begins to kind of ease around, and it doesn't make any difference what she does. I'm going to find an excuse. Why'd you slam that damn door? Where are you going? I don't like what you're doing. So I go out and get drunk. With me, I was so full of self-hate. I didn't like myself. I didn't like me. Self-hate breeds resentments. We strike out. Well, if the boss hadn't have done this to me, or if so-and-so hadn't said this, and if you'd just stay off of my back, if you'd leave me alone, we strike out to those that are closest to us. The ones closest to us are the ones who are hurt most, and in all probability the last ones who ever get us into doing something constructive about our lives. So they do only the natural thing. They want to counter. They say, well, look what you're doing to yourself. Look what you're doing to the children. You've lost your job. Look how much in debt you are. You know, they might as well poured him another drink. Because if anybody knows what he's done, it's him. Because he has been the doer, and he knows it better than anybody what he's done. But what it has done, it has satisfied him. Because he doesn't like himself, and showing him what he's done wrong only proves to him that his evaluation of himself is correct, that he really is no good. It's sort of a perverted sort of action that we seem to fall into, and the thing continues to build and build and build, and we drink and we drink and we drink. We get the wrong impression that just because a man stops drinking that everything is going to be all right. You know, what was in the 12 steps and 12 traditions about the farmer who came out of the cellar after the tornado went by, and he looked around into complete devastation, and he said, "Ma, ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" Just because we stop drinking doesn't necessarily mean that everything's going to be peaches and cream. This old good boy that we so deluded ourselves or had gone completely misinformed, he's only that good guy for a period of time, but he's going to have to learn to live without alcohol. I feel we really don't know how sick an individual is until he has abstained for a period of time, depending upon him, and then we really see how sick he is. Then it gets to be a thinking problem. He no longer has a drinking problem, he has a thinking problem. Then we really have to look into this program that has been here available to us for a good number of years. We really begin to look at it. And we look at steps 1, 2, and 3. We admit it. We made a decision. And so on. But you know, the first three steps, as far as I'm concerned, is an evaluation of our situation. We've made a diagnosis. Heck, after 1950, after I'd been sober for 1 year, I knew I was an alcoholic, and I didn't mind telling people, "I'm an alcoholic, and I know it. Just hand me another drink. I'm a pitiful case, and I like it. I like to be pitied." I made a decision every morning. I turned my will over to him every morning. But by that evening, I was drunk. All I'd done was make a diagnosis. For what purpose? In the big book, there's a chapter in there that says, "Into action." In the big book. I always like to say facetiously, I suggest you read that big book. Sit down with it and read it good. Make notes. Underline special phrases that mean something to you. But it says into action, and that's just to me what it means, into action. Because this is when I put my life, this diagnosis that I've made, I put it into action. I take down my inventory. I sat down with my inventory and I spent 3 weeks. I spent a week writing. And then I got writer's cramp and I started typing. I typed a volume, I bet, that was at least an inch and a half thick. And then when you go to someone to read that inventory to them, believe you me, don't type it. It sticks right out in front of you, believe me. You know, when you write, you can sort of scribble it and can't hardly interpret it, but it seemed like the typing had some psychological effect on me. But I did take the 4th and 5th. The 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th fell into place. And I walked out of there into the cool night air. And I looked up at the bright moon, waiting You know, nobody threw that switch, and none of those good things come showering down on me, and I was real disappointed. Because I thought something was going to happen right now, and it didn't. I went home, and I was terribly disappointed. About a month later, I was seated in my home, and I noticed that the television wasn't on. I noticed that cars were driving up in the driveway, and I wasn't frantic to run out there to see who it was. I began to have a feeling of peace, peace within myself, that was almost a revelation, something that I really enjoyed, something that I began to really look forward to whenever I could have my moments of meditation. But I've had so many difficulties in my recovery. One of the ones that I do want to talk about, because it had so much meaning to me, and the reason it had so much meaning to me is that when I moved to the city, I left my Indian people. I had forsaken them. And like so many years, that when the missionaries came, they looked at all of our cultural beliefs, and we were unable to explain to them because of our inability to translate our Osage language into English. We were unable to explain properly what our beliefs were, and therefore they were regarded as paganistic, and we forgot them. In fact, the law moved in and said, don't you practice them because you may create warfare. So we forgot them. But after 7 years of living in Tulsa, one day I heard a knock at the door. And I went to the door, and there were three elderly Indians. And I let them in the house, and they came in and they sat down. I poured them water. Drinking water has a particular spiritual belief within us that this is the first thing we do. We drink water. But we sit down, and after a period of silence, they said, we want you to come home. We want you to come back to our sacred ceremonial and come back into the drum. You know, I had to turn away from them. I couldn't answer. But they left. And I told my family, and they were overjoyed. But I didn't want to go back. I felt that I wasn't ready. But we did agree to go, and we went through all the ceremonials that we're supposed to do when you go back to this sacred ceremonial. And I was accepted back into the drum. The drum, as I make reference, is an ancient social society that we have been able to preserve to a great degree over a period of several centuries. It's the only thing we have left, the only thing that we have been allowed to have. Here is how we communicate with the Great Spirit. Fortunately, I went back, and I began to take up our beliefs again. And I was amazed, because the old Indians, in their belief, are strong believers in spirituality. They pray. They pray to the Great Spirit, who they regard to as Wakanta. Wakanta, the great unknown. We know that there's something out there that controls everything. We don't know what it is. But this is who we pray to. And you know what they call that? They call that a power greater than ourselves. Where have we heard that before? We pray to a power greater than ourselves. It's a great mystery, the great unknown, but it's out there. And it provides us with all the things of nature, all things that walk. The grass, the river, the wind, the moon, the stars, the animals. Everything that we get in the way of gifts, food, every benefit that we receive really doesn't belong to us. It was given to us by the Great Spirit. And it's up to us to share this. Where have we heard this? What do we get out of this program? And how do we really benefit from it? We give it away unselfishly. But it was so amazing to find that two concepts should parallel. And I began to get a better understanding of myself. And it was indeed a revelation to see all the good that could come out of something that is being forgotten. It's so tragic when I see so few of the old people, the full-bloods, pass on to that land, to spirit land. We don't believe in heaven. We believe in a place that we call spirit land. Indians believe that death is inevitable, that life must go on, and after a certain mourning period, then they'll find another mate and continue on. We've had songs about it. We have such beautiful beliefs, and they are realistic. But here again, every time one of these older members go, or any of us, they take a little bit with them, and it's real tragic. Not too long ago, I decided to go back to the land where I was born. Osage Country. It's a beautiful place. I've always been reluctant because I left a lot of unpleasant memories there. I had a gentleman with me who I had been sponsoring. He had about a year of sobriety, and he was real happy with his sobriety and pleased with the fellowship. And we were inseparable. Whenever we had lunch together and we had gab sessions and attended meetings together, played golf together. And he was from my part of the country. And he says, Morris, he said, let's go home. He said, one of these Sundays, let's get up real early in the morning and go home and just ride around. He said, I haven't been back either. I said, okay. And so we got up one early Sunday morning, and it was cloudy and it was raining. But when we got to Osage County, the clouds began to break and the sun began to come through the clouds. And it began to warm up and it was real cool. And you could smell the fresh rain on the alfalfa, on the Bermuda. And the cattle were lolling around in the pastures, and the sheen on their hides were so shiny. They looked so fat and healthy. And my people, the whole Lookout family, lived down in this huge valley. And there was a long, winding dirt road going down into this valley. And we took this road. And as we came to the second turn, there on the side of the road was a huge sign, about 24 inches by 30 inches. And in large black letters against a white background, it said, "Look out for lookouts." And we stopped and then got back in the car. Not too many words spoken. There's no need. With a lot of us, as you well know, with this extrasensory perception that we so find amongst ourselves, we have an understanding. We can communicate without even speaking out. We could sense everybody's feelings. Well, he and I drove on down to this valley. And there the house was, just as I had remembered it, in real good shape. My grandparents have long since gone. They have departed from this world. But the house remains, and it was in real good shape. And we got out, and much to my surprise, a fellow came around the house and said, "Hello." I looked up, and it was my cousin, a member of the fellowship. And we sat up on a... It began to rain, and so we moved up on the porch. Intermittent rains. Their clouds were moving rather slowly, and there were breaks in the clouds, and the sunlight was coming through. And we all three sat up on the porch, just rather quietly, and we listened to the mockingbird down below by the river. That just sounds so clearly like he was right next to us. And we began to talk about AA. And we soon learned that this friend of mine was a Methodist. And my cousin was of the Native American Church and Indian religion. And I had been raised in the Catholic belief. We were all three of different denominations. But we respected each other's opinions. And we talked rather briefly about our spiritual concept, our belief in the higher power, God as we understood him. And we respected each other for it. And we got up and went out to the car. And we looked around, and I could visualize all of the old Indians, as I used to remember, in their blankets, talking and laughing, talking in sign language, talking with their hands, conversing in Indian. So many of them passed on in their big black hats, seated on their blankets on the ground. I remember that this is where I was born and raised, where I had ridden horseback, chased through the woods with all of my cousins, where we had run bareheaded and barefooted, playing Indian. This is where I used to sit for hours on end listening to my grandmother tell us stories in Indian. This is where my grandfather spoke to us and brought us up on our cultural values. Many fond memories. We got back in the car and we started back up that hill. And as we got to the top of the hill, I gazed over to my right and I pointed to a huge mountain, a mound, that stood so majestically there in the prairies. A freak of nature. It didn't have a tree on it. It stood there, and we got out of the car, and I told my friend, I said, "My grandfather is buried on that hill. This is where he used to go when he wanted to communicate with his higher power. And he could go up there and meditate. And his last request was that he be buried there." And we gazed at that hill, and about that time the clouds broke, and you could see the flag mast silhouetted against the sky along with the huge tombstone. And as they stood out, it was though I could almost hear my grandfather telling me again that this is the way it is, and this is the way it should be. Thank you.